You know, from time to time during the week, I pack up my laptop or my books or whatever I'm using at the time and head down to a coffee shop somewhere. It's kind of a change of space, a kind of change of pace, change of routine, different scenery. And what I find in those places is kind of interesting because a coffee shop, especially the larger ones like McDonald's, Tim Hortons, that kind of thing, you get this cross-section of the world coming through the coffee shop in any given hour of time, especially in the morning. You know, in the morning, you have people leaving early for work. You got people coming off a night shift. You've got people in some places, especially in the winter, who look like they might have been there for a few hours, just having a place to warm up. In a regular coffee shop, you have all these different conversations and little mini dramas going on. You know, some long-lost friends meeting for the first time in years, or some business deal going down or attempting to go down, or some little argument about politics or whatever's in the news at the time. And it's in those spaces, more than in this space really, that I'm reminded why there needs to be a church here. See, so in those spaces you see this mix of the world and remember that people need Jesus. And that the reason this church was planted was because people need Jesus. Now, there's a lot of different reasons I know why people come to church on a Sunday. You might come here to connect with friends, and that's a good reason. There's a social side to the faith. Connecting with friends is a good thing. Maybe you come to worship, to sing the kind of songs we've sung that really give a little bit of a glimpse of eternity and a reminder of who God is and what God is up to and been up to. Some people come to church to give their children just a bit of a rooting and an alternative philosophy than what's floating around out there. And some people come to church just to try to figure out this God thing and figure out which way is up spiritually and what they really believe. And those are all valid reasons to attend a church service. But sometimes I find it's good just to kind of recalibrate a bit and take a step back and remind ourselves why this church is here. In this case, why Lake Windermere Alliance Church is present in this community. And we've talked about that a bit through transition. We'll be talking about that through the fall as we move into pastoral search in the new year. But I just want to start by reading a parable, a couple parables of Jesus in Matthew chapter 13, where Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had, and he bought it." What's the treasure? What's this pearl that's worth so much? A few chapters earlier in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus said this: "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where is your treasure? What is your treasure? And where is your heart? Just hold that question and hold these verses for a moment. Like some people in this church and in this community, I like hunting. And interestingly, I never really started hunting for big game anyway till I became a pastor. What happened was in northern Alberta, you know, looking around at all these hoofed animals running freely around the area, on the one hand, looking at all these animals and all this meat, you know, on the hoof, and looking at the size of my paycheck on the other hand, I realized I could maybe make a connection there and bolster the one with the other. And so I started hunting, and I started, you know, getting some deer from time to time. And then I remember the one year, the big day when I got my first moose. Went out really early in the morning and called this moose into about 80 yards and put the moose down and walked up on this thing, and it looked like it covered about a half an acre. It was just monstrous. And I looked at my little knife, what do I do now? But I got it all figured out. And the interesting thing about that moose was I shot that moose with a borrowed gun and borrowed bullets. And I got it out of the bush with a borrowed ATV. And I hauled it to the meat cutter with a borrowed pickup. And when I went to go get the meat, and there was a lot of meat, this moose was a big moose, it completely filled a regular-sized freezer when it was all cut up. When I went to go get the meat, somebody had paid for all the meat cutting already and all the sausage making, and I thought to myself, this hunting is pretty cost-effective. I think that meat cost me about 2 cents a pound. And so I thought, I got to keep doing this. It's so cost effective. And, you know, I've never had a hunt that was quite as cost effective as that moose. But I like to argue with my financial manager named Kristen that it really is still quite cost effective. That it actually saves us money to allow me to go out there and, you know, get a little bit of meat. But here's the truth, and most hunters, if you press them, will admit this. Even if that meat costs 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 times as much, it's going down the street to Sobeys or wherever and getting some meat, I'd still hunt. We'd still hunt. Because it's not just about the logic of it. There's this passion side about getting out there, about breaking routine, about being in creation, about seeing animals, and from time to time, rarely, bringing something home. There's this passionate side about it. There's a logic, yes, but there's a passion that keeps it going. I may have told some of you about my complex and highly orchestrated and very romantic proposal to my wife, where we were driving down the road one day and I looked over and said, "So, you want to get married?" And she said, "Sure." And then she says, "I nearly blew it because the next word out of my mouth was, 'I just want to get married so I can get on with life.'" And she said, "What? What do you mean by that?" I said, "Hold on a sec, let me explain. It's logical. It makes sense. You know, in Scripture, it seems like there's this thing called the gift of celibacy. I don't have it. I want kids. It's logical. I should get married. I'm going to be a pastor. It's logical in the context that I get married. It's all very logical. It makes sense. That's why I want to get this logical thing out of the way and get on with life. But it's not just the logic that got me married or the logic that keeps us married. You know, from time to time when I'm feeling especially romantic, I'll look over and say, "You know, I kind of like you from time to time. And we're good together. And when we're apart, it drives me crazy. My threshold is about 25 hours, somewhere in there. And it's like, oh, we got to get back together. We just like hanging out together. We like doing life together. We have everything in common." After 30-some years, everything in common. And so there may be this logical reason to be married. Logical reason even to be married to Kristen, but it's not just about the logic. There's a passion to it. There's something beyond the logic that keeps us going. The Lake Windermere Alliance Church is founded on the principle that people need Jesus. And this church has had great seasons of harvest for a lot of people coming to faith, a lot of people being baptized, missionaries sent out, missions supported, missions prayed for. And that's still needed in this world today. And it's very logical that that happens. But to the logic of why this church is here, we need to add the passion. And the nature of a transitional pastorate is it's very internal, dealing with internal church issues, organizational issues and staffing issues and leadership issues. But even in transition, we need to take a step back and look outward. We're going to do that a bit today and look outward and remind ourselves why we are here. And so today we're going to take a look at both the logic and the passion for souls. The logic and the passion for evangelism, for outreach, that it's logical, but there also has to be this heart side to it. A missionary some years ago came up with this little slogan: win the lost at any cost, because people last forever. Win the lost at any cost, because people last forever. There's an old Alliance hymn called 10,000 Souls a Day. It says, 10,000 souls a day are passing one by one away in Christless guilt and gloom. Without one ray of hope or light, with future dark as endless night, they're passing to their doom. In the passage I read earlier about the pearl and the treasure, just after that, Jesus says this: once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. And when it was full, the fishermen pulled it up on the shore, and they sat down and collected the good fish in baskets, but threw the bad away. This is how it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into the blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And one of the logical reasons for being involved in outreach, one of the logical reasons for us to care about people who are not a part of the Church of Jesus Christ, one of those reasons is that people have infinite value and an eternal destination. People have infinite value and an eternal destination. Everybody is going to live somewhere forever. Think about that. Everybody's going to live somewhere forever. And the deciding factor, the fork in the road, is relationship with Jesus Christ. That's the deciding factor. And so because of that, it is logical. It makes sense for us to be involved in reaching people for Jesus Christ. They have an infinite value and an eternal destination. But there's another piece of logic. We also have, in addition to that logic, we have the example of Jesus. Jesus came, he said, I come to seek and to save the lost. And one time he's interacting with some religious leaders who had a hard time with the fact that he was associating with less than religious people. And so he's teaching in Luke 15, the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. Making the point again and again and again that God cares about people who are lost. And then if you're on God's side, you're going to care too. And we have his example of reaching out and dealing with people who are far from God. And logically, if it mattered to him, then it would matter to his people. It's logical. But there's even another layer of logic. In Matthew 28, after Jesus rose from the dead, he says, all authority in heaven and earth have been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. In Acts 1:8, he said, you'll receive power when the Spirit comes on you, and you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So in addition to the fact that people have infinite value, the example of Jesus, we also have the command of Jesus. The command of Jesus. And so it's logical. It's logical. Reaching people if we're followers of Jesus Christ makes sense. But let's be honest, friends. Logic alone isn't enough. Most churches, most Christians would sign off on those facts. But I know that for a large portion of my life, the logic was all in place. I was raised in the church. It wasn't until the passion kicked in that I actually did something about people who are far from God. There must also be a passion. How do you move from the logic to the passion? Well, you first got to be convinced of the logic. But then what? Then what? Like some of you, I grew up in a Christian home. In fact, really, you could say I grew up in the church. You know, one of those families, you know, Sunday school, church, evening service, midweek stuff, maybe a youth group, maybe a Bible study, all kinds of church stuff. Most of my friends were Christians. It wasn't until I got into, you know, high school and really beyond high school that I was spending more time with people from outside the church than people from inside the church. You know, I discovered something as I moved into the world that I wish I'd known. Back when I was in high school, I discovered that most people are not as confident and together as they appear on the outside. People really, we work so hard to act like we've got it all together. And most people are not all together. Especially when it comes to issues of death and meaning and significance and purpose. People are full of questions. Full of questions. You know, people can be great at a party, life of the party, one-on-one, full of fear, not knowing which way is up. They pretend they've got it all figured out, but they're really awash, they're really lost. After high school, I went out line cutting. I canoe raced in the summer and did my trap line in the fall, went out cutting survey lines in the winter, and I would grab a bunch of books off the bookshelf at home, and this one year, I just grabbed this section of books that I refer to as dangerous books. Books about evangelism and prayer and revival. And I was reading these books while I'm out in the wilderness. And I'm reading these books and just hearing all these stories of revival and soul winning and missions. And one day I was cutting the survey line through this stand of poplars. For years I could show you on the map where it was in northern Manitoba. Cutting this line and beautiful day, 20 below, sunny day, just standing there looking beautiful. And I had this thought. These words came to me. You can't convert trees. Weird thought, eh? You can't convert trees. And really, for me, it was the start of saying, you know, you've got this life going on where you're doing all the stuff you want to do, but it has nothing to do with people. And if you're going to have a life that really matters, that it's going to have something to do with people. And so I decided to go to Bible school to learn to share my faith. And I jumped right in, right out of the gate. You know, little kid from the bush in Northern Manitoba jumps right in, campus crusade for Christ. University of Regina, walking up to people, trying to convince them to follow Jesus. And I bumped into all kinds of people I'd never met before, coming from a small northern community. I bumped into communists. And if you know University of Regina, you're going to bump into communists. And I bumped into Muslims, and I bumped into Hindus, and I bumped into atheists, and all these people I'd never really had interacted with before. And I was shocked to discover, unlike the impression I had that there's all these hard-hearted people out there saying no to Jesus, they haven't even heard about Jesus. They haven't heard. They haven't rejected the gospel. They haven't heard the gospel. And I was surprised to discover, coming from my immersion in the church world, that most people think the Bible teaches karma. The idea that, you know, you do good and you do bad, and hopefully your good outweighs your bad, and it'll come back to you. And they have no idea of this thing called grace. They have no idea of the fact that we can't earn it. Jesus died and paid for it all. And it's news to people. They've just never heard it before. And in that time, I also got involved in something called Evangelism Explosion. And through that, saw the first person I ever led to faith, a guy named Grant, inner city Regina, come to faith. And through all that time, and I think probably some of the theology I was learning in college at the time, just this great sense of how desperate and lost people really are without Jesus. Just how empty they are, even when they pretend they've got it all together. And what was happening in my life in this time was that I started having this passion for souls that was added to this logic that I had for years. The logic was always there, but the passion never was. And so what I've discovered is that we need to understand why it's important, but we also have to have a heart like Jesus has for people who need him. That's the only way to make a dent in this world, to make a dent in the masses who need Jesus. So a question I just want to ask you to think about, do you understand the logic? Do you understand logically, biblically, why it's important to reach people for Jesus? Our doctrinal statement makes it pretty clear. But in addition to the logic, is there a passion? Is there a heart? Is there an emotional component, a caring about those who are far from God? How do you stir a passion for the lost? You know, we can sign off on the doctrinal thing, but how do we actually bring our hearts on side with that? First person I ever worked with on staff in a church, a fellow named Dave. He just was a great, great man of God, a single fella. He wanted to maybe be a missionary someday, and he was determined he wasn't going to marry a girl who wasn't at least open to the possibility of going overseas to mission. And Dave was well into his 30s, and he had lots of girls who wanted to marry him. It was kind of awkward. I mean, here's our single youth pastor being hit on by the single moms of kids from the youth group and single moms in the church. It was awkward. It was tough. And he refused to get involved with anybody who wasn't at least open to the possibility of going into missions, because that's where his heart was. And eventually he did find that girl, and they're, you know, serving in ministry right now. But I remember talking to Dave one day as we were wrestling through some of these issues around soul winning. I said, why do some people seem to have a heart for those without Jesus and some don't? Like, what's the difference? What makes the difference? And we kind of kicked it around and mulled on it and kind of came to one conclusion was, well, it looks like that people who care about people without Jesus actually know people without Jesus. They're friends with people who don't know Jesus. Now, I'm not sure if that's a cause or effect. But the deciding factor was people who had no non-Christian friends didn't really seem to care. But people who had friends who didn't know Jesus, who were outside the church, outside of the religious bubble, they really cared about those who are far from God. And so one of the principles, one of the ways we get a passion for the lost is through relating, getting to know people who don't know Jesus. You know, one old stat, who knows if it's still true, upon becoming a Christian, the average new Christian after 2 years has no non-Christian friends. That we get saved and we get kind of enfolded, and that's part of it's a good thing, enfolded in the Christian culture. But then we can get cut off from the people who need Jesus. And that's dangerous. And the truth is that so many Christians have no non-Christian friends. No friends who don't know Jesus. That's probably, for me personally, on a very personal level, one of the most frustrating things I faced in my years as a pastor. It was just so hard. That so many Christians had no non-Christian friends, and they thought it was okay. They thought it was normal. They thought they were following Jesus. But I need to tell you, scripturally, biblically, that if we're going through life and we have no friends who don't know Jesus, that it's not okay. It's not normal. And we need to ask the question whether we're actually following Jesus, because Jesus was described as what? The friend of sinners. He got along really well with people outside the religious circles. And if we're following him and walking with him and working with him, our lives might look a little bit like that. Extreme example. Community we lived in, Kristen was working in a daycare, got to know one of the ladies in the daycare, became good friends with her. And this lady shared how a couple from a church who lived either next door or just down the street from her were good friends with her and her family. And this couple from the church did things with her and her husband and their kids, and they enjoyed hanging out with these Christian people. And one day these Christians, through some wacky end times theology they got, one time these two Christians came to this non-church family and said, "We've discussed it and we've decided we don't have enough in common with you to hang out with you anymore. So we're actually not going to socialize with you any longer because we just really, there's nothing. Nothing in common." And every time I think of that story, I just feel like driving down the highway and slapping someone silly, because how insane is that? People without Jesus want to hang out with people with Jesus, and the people with Jesus don't have time. How crazy is that? And if we're going to have a passion for people without Jesus, we've got to be in relationship. And for a lot of us who are raised in the church and immersed in the church, this will lead to a change the way we live. We'll have to completely renovate the way we live. I've concluded in my life, really, my preference is there's two groups of people I want to spend time with. People who need Jesus and Christians who want to do something about people who need Jesus. There's a third group that can be a great passion killer. That's people who know Jesus or claim to know Jesus and just don't give a rip about people without Jesus. They just don't care. That will suck the spiritual passion, the passion for evangelism, right out of your heart, right out of your body. It's so easy to have the logic, but not the passion for souls. It's so easy to check all the theological boxes and just not care. But one of the things we can do to generate the passion is relating. Another thing we can do is we can read. We can read the Gospels and look at Jesus and how he operated and what he did and how he cared for people who are far from God. We can read biographies and mission stories. And if you're not a reader, there's lots online now. There's videos, there's podcasts where you can capture the passion of others and have some of it rub off on you by reading. You can also go through some retooling. You know, it's kind of crazy when you think of it that I grew up in the church and I had to go to Bible school to learn to share my faith. Kind of weird, isn't it? In fact, it wasn't even in Bible school that I learned how to share my faith. It was in Campus Crusade, a parachurch organization. We need to get aggressive as followers of Jesus in holding our pastors and our leaders accountable for training us to do what the Bible calls us to do. Not just teaching, not just dumping information, but actually equipping us. And we've done some of that, and we'll be doing some more through the fall, some training for evangelism. But there's lots online. And really, all you need to figure out is, what has Jesus done for you? What does Jesus want to do for everybody? Figure that out and how to share it clearly. That's all you need to know to be involved in evangelism. Another thing, this is a big one, rearranging. Rearranging our lives, rearranging our schedules, making time, making space for people who don't know Jesus. I remember one time in our ministry, there's a couple we were getting to know from outside the church, and they called us up and wanted to do something with us. Let's go hang out, let's go do something. My schedule was such, my work was such, that it was going to be a solid month before there's any space in my schedule to get together with these people. How crazy is that? Just completely consumed with the life of the church. I mean, now if that happened now, I would cancel something. I would say, I actually shouldn't be at the board meeting. I should be out there with these people. That's more important. That's the priority. And so we need to learn to rearrange our lives. One church in the States, part of their philosophy of ministry says this: we will purposefully inconvenience ourselves and our personal agendas if it affords an opportunity to tell another person how they can have a relationship with God. We will purposely inconvenience ourselves, set aside our personal agendas, if it gives us a chance to tell someone about Jesus. Leadership program I was in, I told this story at our evangelism training here last spring. One of the days in this leadership training was on evangelism. And what the instructor did is hired a non-Christian to come to the class. A fellow named Scott, sharp guy. University student in Vancouver, very articulate. And he interviewed Scott. And I learned a lot from hearing this fellow explain where he was at. And he was a true spiritual seeker. He wanted to know the truth. And at one point in this interview, the instructor said, "Well, how will you know when you found the truth? How will you know when you found what you're looking for?" The guy said, I'll know when I found somebody else who's found it. And that thought has keep coming back to me. Here's the question that comes back to me. What if Scott moved in next door to me? What if Scott was my next door neighbor? What if he was your next door neighbor? You know, a couple things could happen. He might get to know me, and my spiritual vitality would be so low that really he concludes that, yeah, I'm a church goer, but it really makes no difference in my life. So this is not a person I'm going to find the truth with. Or maybe more likely, I might be doing okay with God and really walking with God and being a Christian, but I don't have space in my life for Scott. I'm too busy, I'm too filled up to get to know this guy right next door to me who God has put in my face to spend time with and get to know him. But maybe if Scott moves in next door to me or next door to you, we'll have the sense, the logical sense and the heart sense to rearrange our lives.
I gotta share a story with you. It's an amazing story and it goes along. I was in the fall and I don't know enough about stars.
Oh, Bill, one story's good. No, the story you made a great point. You made a great point there. And the point I want people to hear is you had a relationship with this guy that allowed you to go out and do stuff. Okay, carry on. But I hope you hear, he was out quadding with this guy in the context of relationship. Not just, you know, distant next door, but in the context of relationship. That's where those conversations happen. And the way it works, 95% of the time in my experience, is you have a relationship with someone, they ask a question, or often there's a crisis in their life. And there you are, already in relationship with them. The gospel is transmitted via relationship. That's so critical. That's so important. So think about Scott moves in next door to you. Scott moves in next door to you. What happens? Maybe you rearrange your life. You get to know him. You create space. He gets to know who you are. He has some questions. He has some anger, perhaps. There's a lot of people with anger towards the church or the caricature of the church or the caricature of God and Christians. And you take the anger. You don't brush them off. And you take the hits, and you love him, and you care for him, and eventually he discovers that you know the one who is the truth. And he wants to come and know the one who is the truth as well. That is how you reach a soul. That's how you reach a neighborhood. That's how you reach a community, in the context of relationship, where the logic is all in place, but there's a heart where you know what's wanting. Back to the start, back to that verse I read. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. What's the treasure? What's the pearl? Talks about the kingdom of God is like this. Well, among other things, friends, the treasure and the pearl is people. Storing up treasures in heaven means populating heaven with people. Everything we do has got to come back to people. They are treasures, and we store them up by reaching them. And so we're going to do some things this fall, through the fall and life of the church, moving in that direction, our kickoff in a few weeks. Our marriage and family series. We have a series in December even already planned called De-Stressing. It's called, actually it's called O Come All Ye Stressful. O Come All Ye Stressful, O Come All Ye Doubtful, O Come All Ye Fearful, Christmas Eve, O Come All Ye Hopeful. Designed to communicate the gospel to people who might not be in this room here right now and help you. But you want to understand, know something? That's all supplementary. That's all supplementary to what you can do and to what I can do and what we must do outside of this space. It happens out there, or it doesn't happen. The relationships are built out there. It's not about, you know, getting your friend into church and pushing them to the front. It's not that at all. It's about being in relationship, having a vital relationship with Jesus, and sharing with your friend what's most important to you. That's really what evangelism is. So my prayer to land this morning is that even now this church, that's us. It's not the organization, it's us. The church is us. That we begin coming more to life in this area of working with Jesus to seek and to save the lost. That we'd understand the rational reasons why, but that he would give us his heart. And that when a new pastor gets here, new leaders, new attendees come, that this church will be so dripping with the heart of Jesus for the lost that it will be unavoidable. That's why this church was started. That's why this church must continue. It's logical, but we need the heart as well. Would you stand with me? Let's pray.